This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us along our Main Street today. We're going to talk about land in the state, North Dakota's industrial area and the oil patch, for example. We're going to low down on that from a couple of authors you may have heard of. And we're also going to talk about agricultural land, what happens when big cities absorb it, in a Harvest Public Media report that we started yesterday. We'll conclude today. Justin Fisk from the Medora Foundation will join us to talk about what's on tap for this year's Medora musical and all kinds of other entertainment as well. And Ashley Thornburg and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. But first, what happens after a boom? North Dakota's oil patch went through that experience, and the question intrigued two University of North Dakota professors. A recent Prairie Pulse television show featured host Matt O'Lean talking with history professor Bill Carraher and social work professor Brett Weber about their book, The Bakken, An Archaeology of an Industrial Landscape. Here's an excerpt of their discussion.
First off, guys, just tell folks a bit about yourselves, where you're from originally, your background. William?
I'm Bill Carraher. I'm originally from the East Coast, from Wilmington, Delaware. I went and did graduate work at Ohio State, and my training was in Mediterranean archaeology, particularly archaeology of Greece and Cyprus. When I got out here to North Dakota, I became, I think as a lot of people do, sort of fascinated by North Dakota. And since 2012, Brett and I have been wandering around the Bakken, documenting the Bakken boom and a little bit of the Bakken bust together. So, yeah.
Okay. Brett, your background?
We're both historians. I currently teach, I'm an associate professor in the social work department.
Right.
My historical focus was more late 20th century social policy issues, and Bill is the archaeologist, so we're both historians but come at that from very different angles. We first were having conversations about this while I had joined Bill on an archaeological dig in Cyprus. He had a team there. He'd been taking teams there for a number of years, and we realized that we had some shared interest in housing issues. So even though he was working, you know, what, 1,000 years earlier, we were both had this shared interest in workers' housing. And we thought, oh, well, we should take that out. And we were hearing about these man camps out in the Bakken and thought we should go out and take a look at that.
So what did you think you were going to find in the Bakken, and what did you find?
Yeah, it's really...
It's a big question.
Yeah, it's kind of complicated. I mean, I think in some ways... We found the short-term housing that we were interested in, you know, I think on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think that I hadn't fully understood the sort of scale of the Bakken. I mean, when it was firing, when we were out there in 2012, this was a 100 by 100 kilometer industrial park. And I think that was absolutely fascinating to me. I mean, just the sights and the sounds and the people and the bustle and the movement. I think that the cover of the book we like a lot, in part because it has that sense of movement to it. I think that's the thing that really gripped me. Our day-to-day research was fine, but the going to and from our sites, going around, you know, being around, going to a service station, going to a truck stop, going to living in a workforce housing site. I think that was pretty enthralling and very unexpected.
And it wasn't just Bill and I. We went out with a number of teams. We
had
some students, but also colleagues from around the country, architectural historians, other archaeologists, a number of professional photographers that joined us. And we had, we kind of jokingly refer to it as a trap line. We had about 50 of these camps that we revisited over the years and watched how they changed and interviewing folks who were living in them. So we were visiting their workspace, but this was our state. So there's some interesting play with who's the native and who's the visitor here. And then, to go back to your original question, what did we find? We found something that was constantly changing. We talk about the Bakken as though it's a fixed place, and every time we visited it, it was a different place. Even the traffic, as the roads were changing out there, the camps would expand and contract. The food choices were changing, and it seemed like in our field trips, about the time we'd think, oh, this is what's happening here right now, something would occur that would drastically alter our perception of what was going on there. So it was a very dynamic place. So we're trying to create a tourist guide of a place that was constantly changing.
Right. Tell me about the people you met out there, the workers. That must have been fascinating.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, this is the coolest thing about. I will defer largely to Brett. To Brett about this, we kind of divided our team to people who are good with things. I'm pretty good with things, maybe buildings. I'm not super great with people. Brett, on the other hand, is really good with people, and I think you're pretty good with things. So there's a lot of like, man, Brett, we talked to this really kind of cool guy. You should go talk to him more because I think we understood some of what he was talking about, but Brett's the people person, mm-hmm. and man, you spent hours and hours. I mean, we probably have close to 100 hours of interviews.
So tell me about the people you met.
We met people from all over the country, some people coming up from Mexico. There tended to be pockets of the country where people had come from, previous oil plays. So yeah. We had people coming up from Texas, but also Idaho, Utah, places where the economy had fallen apart. Mm-hmm. Understand that 2012, we were still dealing with the recession.
Kind of coming out of it, though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But remember, coming out of it, every place came out of it at a different rate. Mm-hmm. Different rate, you know. Right. And so some of these, and plus you had, I thought one of the more interesting characters, we met at least two people from Louisiana, right, who had been mm-hmm. in the petroleum industries down there, and that got simply wiped out by Katrina.
Yeah,
and so they had come up because they could do some of the same stuff. They didn't happen to be doing that, but they could. I mean, it was a sort of a natural.
In fact, because of those folks, we frequently enjoyed catfish and okra and greens sure. because at Capitol Lodge, one of the workforce housing sites that we frequently stayed at, the food, this great buffet every night, was being prepared by cooks from Louisiana.
What were these workers' attitudes toward working there? Safety regulations? Mm-hmm. Did they feel they were protected enough? You know, we hear about all kinds of accidents in the oil industry, that kind of thing. What were their attitudes toward this?
One of the really common jobs in the patch is driving truck. Mm-hmm. And there are regulations about how much you can drive, how many hours you can drive. And this seemed to be regularly violated. Yeah. And we were talking to people who were working just incredible numbers of hours back to back. And it wasn't always safe driving that many hours. But as one of the workers told us, the oil doesn't stop. Mm-hmm. And there were times where we would interview truckers who hadn't driven for several days. And they were still paying for housing here and housing back home. And it was very frustrating for them. Other times, there weren't enough truckers. And so they were driving for days on end straight with nary a break, taking a nap in their truck or in the line at the fracking line or the saltwater disposal line and pushing through there. Another thing that we saw with people was this fantastic American optimism that while things were rough back home, this was their opportunity mm-hmm. To really turn their lives around. This was going to be their nest egg for retirement or to pay off their home. And some of the people were able to fulfill that dream. Others were not.
I think one thing that's interesting is that we tend to associate the boom, right, the population influx as, you know, all people working in the oil industry. And one thing that we encountered pretty quickly was, man, a lot of these people actually aren't working in the oil industry per se, right? They're working in related businesses, from the dude who runs the Williston mm-hmm. UPS shop. We met him, right? Because with the pressure on labor out there, almost every job was open to either, you know, a North Dakotan or someone from someplace else. So you had this kind of intermixing where people were coming out and working construction. They were working on road crews. They were working in truck maintenance. They were working on commercial establishments. They were cleaning hotels, things like that. And they were all there for the same reason, which was the boom, even though they weren't working necessarily in the
directly
oil field,
oil.
Right? You have people living next door to each other who, one guy's in the industry, the other guy's in truck maintenance, the other guy's, you know, driving a UPS truck or something. So I thought that was pretty interesting. It certainly complicated the boom, right? It didn't make it this sort of story of guys living
in... They weren't all oil roughnecks.
Yeah, living in a camp, yeah, going out and work on the rigs and coming home and, you know, drinking a beer on their front porch. It was families. It was people who were working in, you know, almost... certainly people working in white-collar jobs, people who are working in whatever you call them now, gray collar jobs and things like that. So it was revealing to me.
And if I could follow up on that, We call them man camps, but every type of camp that we visited included men, women, and children.
So some did bring their families with. Some
they did. Yeah. And a lot of folks were trying to make a go of it in North Dakota, some of them were able to stay with their families. Many ended up having to send their families back home. There wasn't sufficient schooling, availability.
Also, it's just really hard to live in a trailer.
Yeah.
A lot of people would say that, right? It's really hard to live in a trailer. I'm not a trailer-y guy. Like, I don't camp or anything like that. But I imagine, like, those are cramped spaces. And our interest in sort of ethnographic work ended pretty close to not buying a trailer and living in that camp.
Which had been our original dream.
Yeah.
We thought we were going to go out and do that.
Yeah, that seems like a bad idea.
So these trailers, generally designed for a two-week fishing camping trip, people were living in them year after year, building up structures around these trailers to survive the winters, to cool, changing them to cool off in the summer. We saw some very unpleasant scenes with that. Sewer pipes freezing up, freezing up the entire system for a whole park, and also this phenomenon of hot cotting. Sometimes at the height of it, people renting a bed for so many hours a day and someone else using that bed. So really cramped, difficult living conditions, but this often unflaggable optimism.
What was the attitude of the people who already lived there? Some of the townspeople I know were not happy with how things changed out there, but I suppose others made money if they had land too. So did you talk to those people as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's inevitable. I mean, and I think, again, there's just such a range of attitudes from people who saw this as an opportunity to really invest in their communities and develop infrastructure, and those who just from the very start seemed to not want anything to do with it. And so, I don't know, you probably have more nuanced sense. But
well, in my interviews, I tended to interview in the camps. So some of the locals, the native North Dakotans who had lived here for a few generations, were sometimes managing these camps. In fact, outside of Tioga, a man camp or a trailer park, depending on how you want to identify it, temporary workforce housing, had been there since the 1950s from that boom. Mm-hmm. So this was someone whose family had been running temporary workforce housing for now decades, profiting from, but trying to make sure that they were providing not just housing, but a home for people. So some folks, some communities were more welcoming than others. That changed from time to time. Some of the workers felt like they were being treated with suspicion by the folks who had lived here previously. Others got that and thought, well, that's how I would treat people if they moved into my community. Others felt like North Dakotans were very welcoming. So what, any of these questions you're asking, there was this broad continuum
of one of the things
variation.
That was cool was the number of people. We ran into a couple guys who were like, yeah, we're just going to stay here. We actually really like it. Mm-hmm. And they were thinking around Watford City and one park trailer park owner, I guess you'd call it, or campground owner, trailer park owner, was saying, you know, look, I'm going to zoning meetings. I'm already engaged in the process of defining how this community engages with the boom, in part because he had an investment. He owned land and he was running his company there, but also just because he felt like he was part of this community now. So I think that's one of the more interesting aspects that we saw, that these communities kind of hybridized. And even some people out there who were, I think, visible figures in the communities had come out in the 1970s oil boom, or whose families had come out in the earlier oil boom, or who had gone away and come back because of the opportunities that the boom opened up. And so there really was this kind of, it became very difficult. In one of the early drafts of this book, I used the word local. And one of the reviewers, the peer reviewers of the book, was like, you sure you want to use this word? And I kind of backed away from it and sort of distinguished between, you know, long-term North Dakota residents. But even that, in hindsight, isn't really right, because some people who have, you know, bleed North Dakota, in fact, had only came back relatively recently or had come back because of the boom. And so you had all these different types of yeah, engagements with the sense of place and the sense of being there. And we sort of hoped that this book would sort of open up some of those nuances, maybe complicate the us and them feeling, you know, the locals versus non-locals, and really argue for the Bakken being a kind of constant space of people coming and going. So this boom, while dramatic, wasn't sort of new to that area, right? Whether it's right. the earlier booms or whether it was...
Even agricultural.
Agricultural,
booms.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though it's a book based on research, I know you said you wanted to make it accessible to readers. How did you do that?
Well, we tried to make it fun.
Yeah.
And the idea of touring the Bakken as mm-hmm. a tourist is intentionally sort of... Absurd is too strong a word, but like provocative, right? And it's in a heritage guide series. So we thought this is the type of book you could stick in the glove box, or you could stick in your side pocket there of your car as you're driving, you know, I don't know, from here to Glacier or something. And when you're going through the Bakken, you can pull it out and get a better sense for what you see. And so the book was couched within the kind of great American tradition of a road trip. Mm-hmm. But then we also put sort of Easter eggs in it, right? So if you read the conclusion in particular, the final chapter, I'm kind of giving away, it's like giving away the murder or something, and then go back and read the book, then it sort of unpacks a little more. We tried to allow it to be read in two different ways. One, the sort of erstwhile American tourist driving through the Bakken. What is that tank farm over there? Oh, you can find it in the book. But also someone who wants to engage this landscape in a little more critical way. You can read the sort of back of the book to kind of get where what we were trying to do. And we thought that kind of opportunity to be read on different levels was part of the reason. It was, whether it worked or not, I'll let the readers decide, but was part of the appeal of this kind of book.
And what they'll find, a reader will find in here, is industrial tourism. But it's not just of the recent oil boom. It's also very historic. So there's information about architecture, schools, different buildings throughout churches.
Ponchos.
Let's talk about ponchos on the way to White Earth.
Yeah, a bar that had been built, at the sort of early the 1950s oil boom, and had served the White Earth Rodeo.
Have you been to Ponchos by any chance?
I have not.
Yeah,
and it's on Old Route 2, the dirt road Route 2, mm-hmm. and it's. It may be closed. It was always almost on the verge of being closed, but it was this grand establishment in its prime with a dance floor and multiple bars and 25-cent steaks. And, it had only sort of barely held on during this oil boom. And one dreary afternoon, we stopped by there and thought, oh, this place can't be open. And yeah, sure enough, it was open.
The door was open and there were
people inside. Poncho's son was in there, and we had a long chat. And so, mm-hmm. Bringing out those kind of layers of successive booms and the impact on the landscape and the way in which, again, motion and not tourists in the conventional sense, but people moving had sort of shaped the landscape and the way in which all of those things sort of come together when you're actually out there and looking carefully at what's going on around you.
So you can read into this and find out about the pipelines that you're driving by,
yeah.
Unit yards, but also a place to stop and get a beer at Poncho's or to get a haircut at the Home of Economy as you're entering the patch.
Yeah. Palermo. It's really good patty melts.
About a minute left.
Okay.
Have you been back to the Bakken since things slowed down?
Yeah.
And what did you find?
On and off, right? And
yeah.
So I think the interesting thing about the Bakken is that these landscapes of booms have this kind of remarkable optimism and this remarkable resilience. And I think these are communities that have not only been through booms in the past
and
have learned something, but these are also people who have ridden the crests and troughs of booms, and they sort of know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And which isn't to say that everything out there is, sunflowers and roses, but I think that there is a sort of resilience to these communities, and that this Bakken boom is just going to be another one of these historical layers that the next version of this book is going to take into account. So we're looking forward to the next big oil boom in 5, 7, 10 years to do a revised edition.
And let me contrast that, if I may. At the height of the boom, we had people telling us, this could all shut down tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
During the bust, we had people saying, no, I think it's coming back.
Yeah.
So, again, this complication out there always.
We are out of time. If people want the book, where can they get it?
You can get it on Amazon, or better still, they can get it from NDSU Press. So if they Google NDSU Press, it's from our friends down here in Fargo.
Thanks, NDSU Press.
Yeah, thanks.
Brent Weber, William Carraher, thank you so much for being here. The book is The Bakken, An Archaeology of an Industrial Landscape.
Next on Main Street, the conclusion of a Harvest Public Media report about agricultural land on the edge of big cities.
Game wardens in Maine have jurisdiction just like state troopers, statewide, any crime, anytime. But when it comes to violent crime, they really only deal with violence against, like, trout.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, Zimbabwe, camping, goths, and grace. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As Harvest Public Media reported yesterday, families are increasingly drawn to the open land on the edge of big cities in the Midwest. That population growth has implications for previously rural areas. Today, Harvest reporters Amy Mayer and Erica Hunzinger look at how communities near Des Moines and Kansas City have stretched and adapted. We start with Amy in Iowa.
The historic courthouse in Adel, Iowa, 30 minutes west of Des Moines, chimes the hour from a building bursting at its seams. Renovations just a decade ago added two new courtrooms, but Dallas County Clerk Anna Butler says already, again, there's just not enough space.
Now that's become an issue. It's becoming more frequently over the last few months where we've run out of courtroom space when we have multiple jury trials or multiple even bench trials.
Butler says judges sometimes work out of conference rooms. People wait as cases get delayed. Attorneys' fees pile up.
It's a burden on everybody. It's more paperwork on our end. It's, you know, it's a hassle all the way around.
The county's growing population also demands more from law enforcement. And, perhaps ironically, that may ultimately help the courthouse. When the sheriff's department moves out of the bustling town center and into a new building, Butler says there's a chance the old jail could be converted for use by the court. Meanwhile, Adel itself has added a wing to the elementary school, and new housing is springing up to the south and east, stretching toward the interstate highways that lead to Des Moines and, eventually, similar development explosions in the Missouri suburbs of Kansas City.
I'm Erica Hunzinger. 2 hours south in Clay County, 33,000 acres of farmland went away between 2007 and 2012, and the change is straining streets and schools. The morning buzzer lets students know classes are starting at Liberty High School, which is in a district that has grown by almost 5,000 students over the last 15 years. Chief Operating Officer Steve Anderson says many of those new students live in a residential and retail development area known as Shoal Creek Valley. It's part of Kansas City proper. When Shoal Creek's neighborhoods really started to take off,
I don't know if it caught the district off guard, but there was a point where there were a lot of trailers and just trying to kind of accommodate that more pressing need.
But now, he says, the school district has a handle on its population influx. And while they're still expecting to grow as the county does, the rate is going to slow down.
The Balance Act, obviously, is you want to build enough for the growth that's coming. You never want to overbuild. That would be irresponsible.
Some Shoal Creek kids go to school in the North Kansas City district. Spokeswoman Tammy Henderson said it's grown by the size of a grade school every year for the last 8 years. The district welcomes the growth. New school buildings and upgrades are in the works, and the buses that travel the 82-square-mile district now run on natural gas.
They're much more efficient when they run. So that's helped cut down on the amount of money that it takes to run our buses. Our buses run about, I'm going to say, 2 million miles a year.
And that brings us to what might be the most headache-inducing part of once rural areas sprouting thousands of homes, traffic. Consider a key state highway that runs east and west through Shoal Creek. It's already a four-lane road, but over a three-year period, there was a nearly 60% increase in accidents where it intersects with I-35. That part sees so much traffic that the Missouri Department of Transportation is planning to widen the bridge to 10 lanes. So it's ready for the next wave of people seeking a little space. With Amy Mayer, I'm Erica Hunzinger, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about this summer's plans for the state's number one tourist attraction, Medora. And Ashley Thornburg and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The orange cones and barrels are coming back to a Minnesota road near you. State transportation officials announced the 2018 road and bridge construction season this week, and it totals $1.1 billion. MnDOT's Transportation Commissioner Charlie Zelli says the 253 projects will be targeted this year.
The state highway and bridge system is about 12,000 miles out of approximately 144,000 miles of roadways in the state of Minnesota. Well over half of the traveling miles of vehicles, 5,000 bridges. It gets a lot of use, and so it needs steady attention.
Minnesota Highway Patrol Colonel Matt Langer says construction will touch all parts of the state. Langer urged motorists to pay attention, drive slow, and put down the phone.
If we find a vehicle speeding in a work zone, people should know that that fine costs $300. And so there's a pretty severe penalty that goes with that. The reason that penalty is severe is because it's so dangerous to be speeding in a work zone.
Zelli says despite a large construction program this year, the long-term funding picture remains bleak compared to the system's needs. The Trump administration is getting pushback over the growing trade dispute with China. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has more from an event with farmers, a U.S. Department of Agriculture official, and a U.S. senator.
The latest round of tariffs threatened by China would affect American soybean farmers and cattle producers. At a roundtable in Omaha, U.S. Senator Ben Sasse says farmers are paying for the Trump administration's hardline tactics.
I don't know exactly what the administration's strategy is, but the brinksmanship language they're using sort of misunderstands how trade works.
USDA Undersecretary for Trade Ted McKinney told farmers at the event to be patient. But Bart Ruth is frustrated. He farms corn and soybeans in eastern Nebraska and says the current trade dispute is undermining decades of work building exports to China.
This administration seems prone to whatever the spur-of-the-moment thoughts are that pop into the president's head, and I'm not sure that that message is finally reaching the top like it should.
Farm Bureau President Zippy Duval has called on the administration to negotiate with China before rounds of tariffs damage the farm economy. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And members of the Minnesota and North Dakota congressional delegations are closely watching the President Trump's proposed tariffs on trade with China. Minnesota Democratic U.S. Senator Tina Smith says she hopes that a compromise can be worked out before the tariffs are to take effect in 60 days.
These tariffs that the Chinese have proposed are proposals at this point, and I really hope that Trump administration and the Chinese government can come together and come up with something that would be mutually beneficial. That's where I think we ought to really be.
North Dakota Congressman Kevin Cramer says the president has the right to stand up to China, but he would like to see a more measured approach to lessen the effects on farmers. Senator John Hoeven says he's concerned with Chinese retaliation in the form of increased duties on soybeans, corn, wheat, and beef. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The State Historical Society of North Dakota, as part of their Sensational Sunday series, presents the Good Government Summit, a timely discussion about ethics in government and how North Dakota citizens rate theirs. Sunday, April 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. Humanities scholar and host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson, will portray the third president live and in costume. Merrill Pepcorn will read a Dakota Datebook. And Main Street's Doug Hamilton will moderate a distinguished media panel that includes Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson, along with Amy Dalrymple of the Bismarck Tribune, the Grand Forks Herald's Mike Jacobs, Cecile Warman of Journal Publishing, and Forum Communications' Jack Zaleski. The event is free and open to the public. More information at history.nd.gov/events. The Good Government Summit, Sunday, April 15th, 1 to 4 p.m. in Bismarck.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Justin Fisk is the Marketing and Communications Director for the Theodore Roosevelt Foundation, and he joins us from our microphone in Bismarck. Hi, Justin.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about the big plans you've got for Medora this summer, and it includes an expansion of the other entertainment options, not just the Medora musical, but what you're calling Broadway in the Badlands.
Yeah, we're excited to be bringing a whole lot more entertainment to Medora this summer. Broadway in the Badlands, of course, is something we announced a couple of weeks ago. But what that means is four Broadway-level shows in the Old Town Hall Theater in downtown Medora this year.
So let's talk about some of the new stuff. Wonderful Work, A Harold Schaefer Story.
Yes, very excited about that show. Brand new, under development now. So we're getting snippets as that gets put together. It's the story of Harold Schaefer, the man who saved Medora.
Who invented it.
Yes, exactly.
And that opens June 8th. It plays Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. And then you've got Todd Oliver and his talking dog. Now, there's an intriguing title.
Yeah. So I don't know who the actual star of the show is here, Todd or Irving. But we've had Todd at the Medora Musical as a featured variety act. And he wanted to come back, and people said they wanted to see him. So he's going to be our most frequent performer at the Old Town Hall Theater. It's a really fun show for the whole family.
And it's every day except Tuesdays with two shows on Wednesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. That opens June 8th as well. So mm-hmm. They're going to get a workout.
Yes, they will.
And also new this year, Carl and Greta's Cowboy Sing-Along. That opens June 13th.
Yes, absolutely. Part of what we do in Medora always comes back to families and kids, and we wanted a kids show, and this is being created as we speak, and it's by two Burning Hill singers who their personality is just awesome. It's going to be a cowboy sing-along style show. The kids are going to get involved, and it's going to be a whole lot of fun in downtown Medora this summer.
And then Teddy Roosevelt's Salute to Medora, which opens June 1st. So that's that opens the same day as the Medora musical also starts as well.
Yeah.
Teddy Roosevelt's Salute, that's got to be a classic standard piece there because Joe Wiegand's been there playing Teddy Roosevelt for a few seasons, hasn't he?
Yeah, you're right. This is our foundation show here. This really carries the schedule at the Old Town Hall Theater. And Joe Wiegand is he's the best TR repriser in the world. He won't tell you that because he's modest, but he is. And we're just happy to have him back in Medora this summer in the afternoons.
Well, he's played the White House, and he plays every day except Monday when he opens June 1st in Medora downtown. Incidentally, he was featured in a documentary that was shown at the Fargo Film Festival. Very nice look backstage at all of that, attention to the chief, if you will, character of Medora.
Absolutely. Medora is steeped in history, and Theodore Roosevelt is the center of that. And we have to do a Teddy Roosevelt show if we're going to do any shows. And Joe is the best one out there. It's amazing the amount that he knows about Theodore Roosevelt and his time in Dakota and elsewhere. And it all kind of comes to life in his show.
Well, the Medora musical, that's been running for a long time now. That's been the main attraction for decades. That goes back to Harold and Shyla Schaefer. How many in your audience have seen the show more than once, do you guess?
Oh, man. We were lucky to talk to a lot of people who have seen the show hundreds of times. And what's most gratifying now is we meet families who are bringing their second, third, and we had fourth generation families coming together to the Medora musical last year. So lots of people have seen it many times. And then we get a good percentage who go, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this is here. This is my first time, and it's unbelievable.
Well, for those people who haven't been there, describe the facility.
Well, it's a Burning Hills amphitheater cut right into the side of the Badlands with a butte view of the Little Missouri River Valley. It's an outdoor theater unlike almost any out there. But to try and give you an idea, it's like Red Rocks Theater in Denver, and the show itself is a family-friendly variety show with all kinds of different pieces in it. But the theme is always the story of Theodore Roosevelt's time in North Dakota, a little bit about Harold Schaefer, a little bit about the American West, and it always ends with a big patriotic finale, which Harold insisted on in 1965, and we still do it today.
Well, on a beautiful spring or summer night, it's an extraordinary experience to have that show with the view behind it. I remember vividly a tableau with a cowboy and a horse set against that beautiful backdrop of the Badlands. So.
You know, we're famous for our ghost ride, which is an in-the-dark, spotlighted ride down a butte in the background of the stage. We've been doing that for years and years, and it's a difficult ride for the folks in the show who ride a horse down the hill as Teddy Roosevelt or another character in the show, and we still do it every night.
Well, what's new this year?
So new this year is a brand new theme. We were really happy with the reception of our Heroes theme last year. And this year it'll be all about family, families in the musical, families that come to the musical, and the importance of family in today's world. And TR had really strong and good opinions of family. And, of course, he had a big wild one as well. So that's going to be the biggest new piece of the Medora musical. And then there's always the theme that runs throughout the show about Teddy Roosevelt and the American West that we get to experience in Medora today.
Well, speaking of family, the host is Chet Wolin. Is there a family member also on stage with him?
Yeah, Chet, he's been on stage with us for a long, long time, and he'll be performing for thousands of folks this year with his wife, Candace Lively Wolin, who they met in Dolly World years ago and started performing in the Medora musical together, married a couple of years ago, and really they're two of the stars of the show, and it's cool that they're husband and wife and spend their summer working on this show in Medora.
Well, years ago, Bill Sorensen was the mayor of Bismarck, and he's got this other career working for you guys at Medora. He's a co-host, right?
Yeah, we've got Chet leading the ensemble, the cast, but Bill is there kind of to give him a hard time, and he's so good at it. His brand of humor and storytelling is so good. We're happy to have him back this year. And I was joking with him earlier about being the grandfatherly figure. But that's true. He offers such an insightful kind of wisdom to the show that it's going to be an interesting way to tell the stories this year with him and Chet together.
Well, next time I see him, I'll call him Grandpa Bill.
There you go.
Who's the fellow from Stratford, Connecticut, who's a co-host as well?
Ken Kirikone. We're excited to have him back. He's a very multi-talented performer, amazing voice, and great actor. And so he brings a little zaniness, a little bit of fun with the kids. And we're excited to have Ken back this year to see how he can spice it up for the show and carry that story throughout our two-hour-long show.
And your Burning Hill Singers and Coal Diggers Band, all those people that do this nightly show, they range from Maine to Florida to Arizona. But you've got some North Dakota talent as well, right?
Yeah, we do. The first thing that we have to do each year when we audition and start casting is look for top-level talent. And that's why you see folks coming from across the nation to be in the Medora musical. But when we can, we get to bring in some North Dakotans who meet the threshold for talent, and we're lucky to have Taylor Leet back in the show this year. She's a Bismarck native. We've got Misty Cope out of Grand Forks. She's returning this year. And, man, just one of the powerhouse singers in the cast this year, Alyssa Scott from Fargo, is joining as well. And speaking of family, there's a lot of couples that are coming back. Christy Robinson, along with Andrew Crow, are a couple. We've got the band leader and a Burning Hill singer there. And Alyssa Scott bringing her significant other, Adam Vogel, who's our lead guitarist. So many talented people come together to put the show on each and every night in Medora.
And how many shows will they do in a summer?
They're going to do about 100 shows. Wow. With 3 nights off this year.
Okay.
It takes a lot of stamina, and only the pros can do it.
Okay, where do they stay?
Well, all the cast stay in Medora. They've got a private residence compound that they stay at. They do affectionately refer to it as the compound, but it's in Medora. It's in the Badlands. A lot of them like to spend their free time during the day doing a little bit of writing, working on their music. Some of them, like Andrew and Christy, will be doing the Cowboy Sing-Along show, and others pick up other jobs just to fill the time and do a few other things and enjoy the Badlands.
And you have new lodging for folks this summer, right?
We do. We're working on it currently, but we have the Elkhorn Quarters opening for the tourist season. It's going to be really neat because it's kind of a tiny house lodging facility, which is really popular right now. And I think TR would be proud with our effort. It's a reused property that offers micro lodging, tiny house lodging, and it's all going to be themed around the Elkhorn Ranch. And it gives people the opportunity to stay at a really fair price with their family and get out and enjoy the Badlands, get on the Mottahe Trail, get out to Bully Pulpit Golf Course, and they can do it. They can do it a few times a year without breaking the bank.
And your news release caught my eye because it has the lead line. This is a $6 million solution to what was a $20 million problem.
Yeah, that's right. We started looking at a need to replace the bunkhouse lodging facility a few years ago. And by all estimates, to replace that property with something new, it would cost upwards of $20 million. And this opportunity came around to reuse a workforce housing facility left over from the early days of the Bakken boom. And it's much, much better construction than what we had. It's on concrete foundations and nice and quiet and cozy. And it allows us to solve that problem while adding some more lodging for guests and for our student workers each summer at a far reduced price than that $20 million price tag. We're going to end up at about $6.5 million.
Well, Justin, bully to you. And here's to a great summer at Medora.
Thanks for having us.
Justin Fisk is the Marketing and Communications Director for the Theodore Roosevelt Foundation. What's happening is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
When I come back to them, I may be fonder and prouder than ever of my little women.
Joe, Meg, Beth, and Amy, iconic names in American literature. They are the March Sisters of Concord, Massachusetts, created by Louisa May Alcott in her timeless novel, Little Women.
Four small children is a recipe for heartache, headache, and indigestion.
A new masterpiece BBC television production will premiere on Prairie Public in May, but you can get a sneak peek at special one-hour premiere screenings on Sunday, April 29th at 2 p.m. at the Prairie Public Studio in Fargo and at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. The event is free and open to the public, but please do let us know you'll be attending by registering at prairiepublic.org.
Well, we've been talking about the snow going on across the state of North Dakota today, but apparently it's starting to abate, and we can look forward to a weekend of other things to do besides complain about the weather, I hope.
Well, this weather makes me want to drink, so I'm going to start with a wine tasting event Saturday, the 7th in Jamestown at the Arts Center, where you can celebrate the life of Thomas Jefferson, who, as you may know, was a wine enthusiast, a garden enthusiast, and you'll be sampling four wines inspired by his personal preferences, and you get to learn about those from a wine expert. His name is Samuel Y, and he will be giving a little presentation about the wines and pairing this with appropriate cheeses. And of course, there's a dessert. 2 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, the 7th in Jamestown at the Arts Center. And tickets are anywhere from $35 to $45.
Well, I'll stay on that theme. It's Beavers Brew and Burgers Saturday in Minot at Souris River Brewing. The Minot State University Alumni Association, along with Souris River Brewing, will host the second annual Beavers Brew and Burgers. The event, which celebrates both International Beaver Day and National Beer Day on Saturday, April 7th, I'm going to have to mark my calendar, will run from 6 to 8 p.m. at Souris River Brewing. It's an exclusive event with limited tickets available. The cost is $40 per person. It includes a burger and fries, a pint of beer in a commemorative glass, a stainless steel bottle opener, and prizes. Again, the hours are 6 to 8, Saturday, April 7th at Souris River Brewing in Minot, and the cost $40.
There is a reception at the James Memorial Arts Center in Williston on Friday. That's the 6th. There is going to be an opening reception for a college student. Williston State College's Austin Proctor is putting up his very own solo show. This is his debut solo show. It's called Spirits, and there is a reception that is open to the public. Come support this local artist Friday the 6th in Williston at the James Memorial Art Center, and it's free, 7 p.m.
And let's stay in Williston. Odell Bazell at Williston State College. Through dynamic inspirational stories, Odell teaches people how to unify in a world that wants them divided. Odell Bazell will be speaking in The Well at Williston State College on April 9th at 7:30 p.m., and the public is invited. His main speaking topics are on leadership and diversity, and it's appropriate for all age groups. Again, 7:30 p.m. at The Well at Williston State College. That's Monday, April 9th, and it's free.
Well, I like the idea of celebrating diversity, so I'm going to stay on that theme with the University of North Dakota African Culture Night. This is Saturday, April 7th in Grand Forks at the UND Memorial Union. This is put on by the African Student Union, and this is the third edition of African Culture Night, and this year's theme is royalty, and they're going to go all out here creating an atmosphere of song and dance, artists, a fashion show. But it all has a serious issue here, raising awareness about issues that stem from the community here, what it's like living very far from home, what it's like back in their home countries. This is open to the public 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Saturday, April 7th in Grand Forks at the UND Memorial Union, and it's free.
Well, Sunday in Fargo at the main library downtown, there will be an event called Favorite Poem Reading. It's inspired by U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky's Favorite Poem Project. The event is an opportunity for the community to get together and celebrate the importance of poetry by reading a favorite poem out loud, as they are meant to be read. Some special guests might be present, and light refreshments will be served. The event is free. It's open to the public, and registration is not required. Again, it's the Favorite Poem Reading at the Downtown Library in Fargo, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, and it's free.
Another great Sunday afternoon event, Sunday at the Opera, this Sunday, April 8th in Bismarck at the Heritage Center, as the University of Mary Vocal Arts Ensemble is presenting these works here that come from Hansel and Gretel. They come from La Boheme. Lots of different operas here being presented at 2 p.m. Sunday, April 8th in Bismarck at the Heritage Center. And it's free.
Well, this is my pick, and that is going to be the Fargo-Moorhead Opera Presents Soldier Songs. We featured this discussion yesterday on Main Street. The show is Friday and Sunday, that's April 6th and 8th, at North Dakota State University's Festival Concert Hall in Reinecke Auditorium. This is gripping and realistic. This is not your traditional opera. It's sort of a song cycle approach. Soldier Songs traces the shift in perception of war from the age of 6 to the age of 66. We'll follow the lead character through the phases of life from boy to man. This is almost a one-man show in a sense. The lead character is on stage for the whole thing. And it plays violent video games as a boy. He enlists and serves in the military. He deals with the real-life horrors of war, and later in life, dealing with the real-life horrors of the aftermath. And he becomes a father whose worst fears are realized when the news of the death of his son comes to him. This production has adult themes. It's not suggested for young children. There will be program elements in front of the opera presentation and after it, and veterans are certainly encouraged to attend. It's 7:30 p.m. Friday, 2 o'clock on Sunday. The cost ranges from $40 to $80.
Well, my pick is Think and Drink Justice in Harry Potter, Sunday the 8th in Minot at the Tap Room. Unless you were living in a cave in the 90s and 2000s, you know that Harry Potter was a huge cultural phenomenon, and you can get together, have a beer, have an intellectual discussion about good and evil and what we can learn from these fictional characters. 12:30 to 3 o'clock in Minot at the Tap Room. It costs $15 to get in, and of course it's at a tap room, so you do have to be 21 to participate.
And that what's happening.
The International Music Camp is taking registrations for its 63rd season at the International Peace Garden, offering over 40 week-long programs this summer, including band, choir, orchestra, dance, drama, piano, musical theater, and visual arts. There is also a four-day session for adults. The early bird registration deadline is May 1st and is available online at internationalmusiccamp.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 5th. School Hill marked the end of John Christensen's journey west. He was a 21-year-old German immigrant riding a freight train with three horses, lumber, machinery, and goods belonging to him and other men who would be arriving later from Wisconsin. Christensen volunteered to ride with the goods to what would become New Salem, North Dakota. In 1882, a group of evangelical pastors had formed a group in Chicago interested in settling people on the plains. The Northern Pacific Railroad had gone through Dakota Territory and had offered to lay out a new city along the tracks for prospective settlers. The chosen town site was named Salem. Around noon on this date in 1883, John Christensen arrived at the site and was left on his own, in the middle of nowhere, with only the rail line and the unloaded possessions. He climbed School Hill, where he discovered a large town of prairie dogs, a sight that entertained him for hours. That night, he camped under an overturned wagon box by the rail line, but didn't sleep much due to the howling of coyotes and the moaning wind. In the night, a train climbed the long grade from the east, continuing a few miles past to a siding. There, it left the cars, carrying the other settlers who would form the colony. Hours later, they joined Christensen, and the town began to take shape and was quickly renamed New Salem, avoiding confusion with another Salem in southern Dakota. In those early days, the settlers depended on water from a railroad tank car, and they lived in boxcars until the railroad built a settler's house, after which the settlers built shacks on homestead claims. Food became scarce early on, and a bread sack from Bismarck was thrown from the daily train as it roared by at full speed. One man soon established a flour business, easing the need for bread deliveries. Members of the Sioux tribe historically lived in the area and watched as settlers plowed the prairie, wrong side up. New Salem grew during the summer of 1883. A church went up, a land office was built, and a few stores opened. Today, the town is home to a little under 1,000 people. School Hill continues to tower above the town, graced by the world's largest Holstein cow, Salem Sioux. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Congress is demanding answers from Facebook about why millions of users' data were compromised by a consulting firm that had ties to the 2016 Trump campaign.
I want to know how many people have potentially been affected, what they should have been doing about it, and how they're going to protect people's privacy and their information.
But before CEO Mark Zuckerberg heads to the Hill to testify next week, Facebook executives respond. That's on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein joins us to preview Sunday's episode of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, when he visits with Kathy O'Neill. She's the author of books on data science, and this Sunday's episode of Why is titled, Does Big Data Threaten Our Democracy? Also on Friday's show, our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson, and Matt Olin will review the new Steven Spielberg movie, Ready Player One. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.